If you are regular attendees, they have my microphone working this week, so I'm sorry, bad news for everybody. Let me turn this over to staff to give an update on some of the materials and answers to questions that came out of last week's committee hearing. Dr. Bukovian.
Thank you, Chair. The agenda basically is the same as we followed last Monday. There'll be an opening with an informational hearing, and at the Chair's discretion, inviting anybody from the audience who may want to come up and talk to the conceptual draft of Senate Bill 329. It's at the dais, and copies is marked by Senate Bill 329, Draft 31207. We'll then close and have a public hearing on Senate Bill 27 afterwards. Also at the dais is a copy of ARP Oregon's full testimony that ARP said they would deliver, and there's extra copies out in the audience. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back over to you to for the informational hearing.
Actually, I think Senator Bates is the chair tonight. I don't really know.
I've lost track. Carry on. And it doesn't really matter.
Actually,
it just doesn't really matter.
Because you had the microphone, it didn't work.
You started it. You keep going.
I don't care. Let me invite anyone in the audience that wants to testify on the conceptual amendments to 329. I think that's very good work that's been done to date. And as we go forward here and incorporate, which I think most of you now know, the major thrust of this committee, not the only, but the major thrust of this committee will be to be joining Senate Bills 27 and 329. This conceptual work that's been done has been very fundamental and has improved the bill. But we also want to acknowledge that there's still quite a bit of good in some of the other proposals, in particular the Oregon Health Policy Commission with their continuous improvement piece. I think that's an exemplary piece of work that would help make both the major tenants in 27 through 29 that much better. I see we have the list on Senate Bill 329. Is Patricia Jensen, and she lives more than 100 miles away. Is Patricia Jensen?
No, I'm here, but can I check the line?
Well, you are totally disqualified then. I mean, you are more than welcome to come up and testify. We're going to have public testimony on 27. We're just going to be free-flowing today. So if you have, you are more than welcome, Patricia, to come up and say whatever you would like to say.
Okay, thank you.
And if I could do some perfunctory work here, I will also open a public hearing on Senate Bill 27. We're just happy to have you.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Co-Chair Westland and Co-Chair Bates, thank you for letting me be here. My name is Patricia Jensen, and I am a utilization nurse. I've been one for 15 years at a hospital. I don't sell insurance. And I'm here today just as a citizen representing my own viewpoint, and you'll hear a little different perspective from me. Are you all hearing me okay?
You're doing good.
Okay. I've tried to come to most of these meetings, and thank you all for your hard work. I'm impressed by your knowledge, really, by the questions you ask and the care you're giving in this important topic. Please accept my comments just from my experience, and as I say, you're going to hear a different perspective from me. I don't want you to think that I'm cold-hearted. I've had hardship in my family, and I understand a lot of the pain of health care issues. I've cared for my elderly father, lived with me for a year. I also had some interfacing with the VA hospital in Portland. So I just want to share as my experience with you as we move forward. And I do agree we have to change the system, but truly it could be worse. And so I do want to make sure that we go in the right direction. There's a lot of talk about utilization in the new system, and believe me, there is a ton of utilization going on right now. We have dramatically increased the size of our department at the hospital, about fourfold in the 15 years I've been there. We keep getting new duties and new research projects and things to check on and monitor, and lots of mandates that trickle down to us. We review every patient's chart for severity of illness and intensity of service. And we use interqual criteria. So I don't know if any insurance people are here, you know what this is, and you folks may know as well. It's what Medicare uses, and this is an older edition, but it's very detailed by body system. It's hard to make patients meet the criteria. And it's down to what's their CO2 and their potassium and things. They have to practically be critical to meet criteria. So we look at every patient every day. For many patients, we then call their insurance company. Now, if you're in the hospital, you may not know that somebody like me is looking at your chart every day, likely calling your insurance company, making an argument for you staying another night. We're not willy-nilly, they're in for however long. No, we're arguing for your coverage. And if you don't meet, we're like saying they need to go. So we are seriously doing this. And we're held accountable, because if an insurance company won't approve another night, then you might have to pay. And then I have to come give you a letter of non-coverage. So it's very transparent what's going on within the hospital as we interface with insurance. And some companies want a daily review. Some insurance companies yet hire another agency just to handle their utilization piece. And that's who we are calling. There's many layers of it going on right now. Medicare reviews charts. The Oregon Health Plan companies review charts and often deny claims, I might add. And usually they're held harmless, and the hospital just has to go without that reimbursement. Utilization is a very expensive layer of healthcare bureaucracy. Does it save money, or does it just increase healthcare costs? And how many case managers does a patient need? My services don't come cheap. Nurses are paid very well. What if we let the doctor determine the most efficient plan of treatment? There's been much discussion about practice guidelines. Part of my job is to see if standards of care paperwork have been placed on the charts for certain diagnoses. These are useful guides, but do we really want a template of practice? Everyone is unique and has their own genetic and physiological and their own unique body system issues. And I resent it if a doctor treats me in a presumptuous fashion and says, well, you're this old, so you must need to be on this drug, or makes quick decisions about what medications I should be on or what treatment plan. Please don't stifle the creative healing process. We want doctors to treat us using their assessment skills and the knowledge of our unique risk factors. The treatment plan should be a collaborative process and should be returned to healthcare individuals and their providers. The campaign for electronic record keeping puzzles me. It is not a cure-all for our healthcare crisis. This morning I worked at the hospital and the computer crashed. I was on two different software systems at once, and it was a big waste of my time for about 10 minutes while I could not get back on the system. And I don't do patient care. Imagine the patient care workers could not access any information on their patients. I can honestly testify that since we adopted electronic record keeping, it takes me four times as long to do the same amount of work. It's an immense burden to log on and off every time I step away from the computer. No longer can I check a simple piece of information at a glance. Nurses have to work as data entry clerks, removing them from precious patient care time. Information is not readily available, and charting is burdensome. Further, privacy is seriously threatened by electronic record keeping. Personally, I don't want my healthcare records kept in a master data file somewhere. Knowing that makes me want to edit what information I share with my healthcare provider. Many of these mandates simply increase the cost of care provided, and the costs are what need to be simplified. That is where transparency is most useful. Please do determine true costs. Publish this and use this as a guide for allowable billing. No more discounts and cost shifting. Everyone should be billed the same amount, and for a time at least, we should cap medical fees until the changes in the system result in a trending down of costs. Coding, billing, reviewing claims, discounting, denying, appealing. Paperwork currently uses up 28% of our health care dollars. Now I'd like to suggest some model changes that appeal to me. First off, get employers out of the health insurance business. Everyone, regardless of who they work for, union status, or the current benefit package they currently hold, need to purchase their own insurance. Government workers should not be entitled to a higher standard of health care than the workers who provide it. It's a fact that for most folks, a privately purchased plan has a much lower cost than an employer-provided plan. Affordable plans do exist, although most people don't know this because we're so busy telling them that they can't afford it. I recently read a press release on the legislative website promoting the Children's Health Plan that it costs $11,000 a year to insure a family. From my research, I found that in Oregon, in 2006, the typical cost to insure a family with a high deductible health savings account plan was $325 per month, which comes to $3,900 per year. Further, of adults 18 and over, the highest percentage of uninsured is aged 18 to 24. 35.4% of this age group opts to not buy insurance. Yes, I say opts because a plan for someone aged 0 to 19 can be purchased for $33 a month. And that figure I'm quoting from LifeWise, and I have their literature of their current fees right with me tonight. And for ages 20 to 24, the same plan costs $42 a month. For the cost of a cell phone plan, these young people could purchase their own health insurance. I don't have a cell phone, but my boys in their 20s have always had health insurance, and if they don't have it through their work, their dad and I buy it for them. I think that, while I'm on that point, let me add, I think people need to prioritize. We don't have cable TV, but we have health insurance. And I think that people don't want to buy health insurance, and there's this misconception that they can't afford it. Okay, maybe you know where I'm going with this, but let me preface that by making the point that it seems that we are wanting to provide prepaid health care rather than insurance. Insurance is for the unexpected event, the big expense we can't afford. It is to ease us through difficult situations. It isn't for everyday expected events of life, the occasional antibiotic, going to the doctor with a bad cough, going to the ER with a minor injury. We should be able to handle these expenses. Yet, there is a population of people who live with predictable major expenses. These are the chronic renal failure patients, congestive heart failure patients, cancer patients. Insurance isn't a good fit for these folks. They are expensive to care for. They know it. The insurance companies know it. For them, prepaid health care is the model that would fit. Perhaps we should consider separating out this population that has higher needs and expenses and tailor a package for them to case manage to ensure that they receive the care they need at a reasonable cost. This could be based on the OMIP model with patients paying a portion of their premium. I can see coming up with a plan to assist the high-risk group with a prepaid model. For the rest, the most efficient thing to do is to get out of the way and let them take care of themselves. They will need a little help. This is where the government can direct them. Develop some guidelines for teaching the public how to be good consumers. There will be out-of-pocket expenses. There should be. That's one of the costs of caring for oneself. And obviously, if a couple has children, there are expenses that come along with that. If people don't know that, it's time they did. Educate the public on the fundamentals of purchasing insurance plans. Hold insurance fairs where people can attend seminars, compare different insurance products and prices, promote health savings accounts, which offer wonderful benefits as a tax-deferred savings method. I'd rather pay myself than pay the insurance company. With a high-risk option for those with serious needs, the remaining population should be able to find health insurance they can afford. This will save employers and government agencies a huge amount of money, which, as part of your plan, could be diverted to funding the high-risk pool. Further, simplifying billing and capping true costs, and providers get paid, which lowers their fees as well, will lower overall health care costs. For those who say we can't change behavior, we already have. We've made people the way they are by allowing the government to interfere with the economic forces that shape the normal purchase of services. We've removed the consumer from the loop. Instead of enabling dependence on the government, let's enable autonomy. Instead of being happy because of how many people we've signed up to be on the government plans, let's take pride in the fact that Oregonians are autonomous, self-sufficient individuals who are able to provide for their own needs. Instead of bringing us all down to the lowest common denominator of a health plan designed by a government committee, raise up those who have been told they can't care for themselves because they can. Create autonomous consumers, provide for high-risk individuals, simplify the billing process, identify true costs, and control these, at least in the short term, and don't create expensive mandates for providers. These efforts should provide needed reform in our state. Thank you.
Any questions for Patricia?
Just real quick, if I could. Ms. Kocher.
And my guest.
Hi, thanks for coming. What hospital do you work at?
Salem.
It's not a long walk anyway.
Pardon me?
It's not a long walk anyway. Tell me, what I'm interested in here is you work inside the hospital.
Yes.
Right? And are you a floor nurse or?
I have been a floor nurse. I've been a home health nurse, but I've done utilization management for 15 years.
Okay. I was most interested in your issues around the hospital because that's where you worked. The biggest exploding cost in healthcare right now is the cost of going to the hospital and being admitted and being taken care of there. And that's exploded past everything else now. It used to be pharmaceuticals, but now it's hospitalization. What were the things you would like to see changed in a hospital setting to bring healthcare costs down?
Well, I can think of a couple things that that Medicare could change immediately. And that's the three-night rule for inpatients before they can go to a skilled nursing facility. They have to be inpatient status for 3 nights first. Now, we are so efficient here in Oregon, as you know, that most people don't stay 3 nights. And there are cases where a patient is ill enough to meet criteria to be an inpatient, but they're ready to go. Maybe they've had a minor stroke, but they can't go home. They meet nursing home, skilled nursing home criteria. But I won't say that we keep patients a third night, but let's just say that's an issue.
Let's just say it's an issue. It's an issue at the hospitals I work at, too.
Yes. So that should be eliminated.
Let me explain that to people who may not know how this works. In the last 5 or 10 years, we've been moving people more and more. That used to be hospitalized for 7, 8, 9, 10 days, 14 days. We move them to a skilled nursing facility to continue their recovery. If you have a knee replacement, as an example, you commonly will spend a few days in the hospital and then go to a nursing home for your rehab and physical therapy before you're ready to go home. 15 years ago, you'd stay in the hospital the whole trip. But because of the cost of the hospital now and how efficient we are in Oregon, many of those people are ready to go in 3, 4, or 5 days, depending on the case. What you're driving to is there's a rule in Medicare that they will pay for the nursing home or the rehab facility for a period of 45 days, I believe.
Well, I think it's 21 days.
21 days.
And then
but you have to be in the hospital 3 days to qualify for the 21 days in the nursing home. And it's insane. And so if you're really an efficient system like you're speaking to, you get held there. Not really, of course, but you get held there because of your medical needs until those 3 days are up, and then you can go. And that's an extra cost, I think, that we're talking about here.
Yes.
So that's what you're
yes.
driving to.
Yes, yes. And a second thing is this thing called observation status, which Medicare had to create because they didn't want hospitals getting reimbursed for DRGs when a patient really was in and out of there fast, and they shouldn't really pay them the full DRG if their pneumonia got resolved very quickly. So then we have observation status, which they now actually don't pay us at all for. But it is a huge billing, coding, bookkeeping. We look at every observation patient every day. If they go over 24 hours, well, should we make them an inpatient? And it creates a huge bookkeeping nightmare. And if they instead just said, we'll pay hourly up until 48 hours, and after that, we'll pay our whatever formula, DRG, whatever, hopefully they're going to come up with something new. But they're always afraid somebody's going to cheat them. And this fear that someone's going to cheat them has created this huge game of regulation back and forth. And for every rule that's made and every mandate that's made, believe me, the hospital adds a bunch more staff to to carry that out is a huge burden. But of course, the hospital bills being so high, and my husband just had back surgery, and between the surgeon and the, I mean, it was about $65,000. But of course, it's cost shifting, and I think we all know that. It's all the folks that don't pay, and then the rest of us have these huge bills. And so it's not reflective at all of the true cost, and that's why I say we have to define those true costs. You know, how much is it really to have an MRI? Is it $3,000 or is it $300? You know, and so I think we need to really standardize, uniform that so that everyone is paying a fair, same amount, whether they have insurance or not, if they're on a deductible or whatever. And I think if more was high deductible plans and people did pay something out of pocket, I think the cost would come down. You'd really eliminate a lot of this silly game playing. And I know you mentioned at one meeting, Co-Chair Bates, about, you know, you get the bill. Is it the bill? No, the insurance company. You know, and it's like you're back and forth and you're waiting and, oh, here's the discount and here's the way, you know, and it's very complicated. And it doesn't need to be. It needs to be simple.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, if I could make a comment. What I'm hearing here from you is two things. One, that we need some way of addressing these issues, not just Medicare, but other issues also. And I think that leads us probably to a trust board that can sit down and make these kind of changes for us. The other thing is everyone's very fearful of the discussion of any kind of Medicare reform. It terrorizes people. They're afraid that it automatically means I lose benefits, I don't get taken care of anymore. But I would say there's many things in Medicare that need to be changed that would make the system better for the recipients and end up having better benefits and better care. And you've illustrated a couple of them right here for us. And I appreciate your testimony because it leads us right directly where we're trying to go. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I heard Patricia saying one other thing, which is that something I think all the plans have been espousing, and that is there needs to be some individual cost responsibility on behalf of everyone. Everyone needs to have some skin in the game. It's not, you know, buying the six-pack of beer or the cell phone or whatever. So I appreciate those comments as well. Thank you for your excellent testimony.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, as long as we're Patricia was on 329, there's one other testifier on 329, and if this individual wants to testify on 27 as well, since he signed up there, let me get Scott Gallant to the witness stand, please. Thank you for being here, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I be excused for a few minutes? And
Yeah, and I've got a change here in my
tire, so we're out of here.
Yeah.
We'll review your testimony on tape later, I'm
yeah.
sure.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm the Associate Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Association. I heard on public radio last night part of a speech that someone was giving. They were describing democracy as two wolves talking to a lamb about dinner. And I couldn't decide today which of us were which in the process, but I think it's probably apropos. This is a messy business and a complex business, particularly in health care. I'm going to try not to read my testimony, which I'm sure you will appreciate, but there are a few things that I think are imperative that I quote, because I'm quoting from people who are more learned than I am. But first of all, I want to compliment both of you and others, because I think there are others in the building who have been exceedingly tenacious in pursuing this process to create a framework for us to get from point A to point B, hopefully for a system that is more efficient, more effective, and in fact has a great deal of competition in it, competition that actually makes sense, improves care, and does a lot of other things, because I think we're unfortunately caught in a web today that is very unfortunate, and this is what I mean. We're now working in a zero-sum game, according to The authors are Michael Porter and Elizabeth Olmsted Kaisberg, which essentially means that everyone is trying to shift costs onto someone else. And we're all guilty of that. They say, for example, all system participants seek to lower their own costs by shifting the burden to other parts of the system. Costs are shifted from payer to patient, from hospital plan to hospital and vice versa, from hospital to physician, from health plan to the subscriber, from the employer to the employee, from the employer to government, from the insured to the uninsured, from government to private insurers, from states to the federal government. And that is absolutely true. Competition as it is currently structured has created a series of perverse incentives to increase market share at the expense of the efficient delivery of services in order to gain more clout in the battle to capture more revenues, raise prices, push costs on to others, and to extract discounts. Many people know that healthcare consolidation, in fact, has done just the opposite. It has increased costs because we have limited markets, we have limited entry, we have stifled the ability to be innovative for the right reasons, and that is quite unfortunate. In the scheme of trying to devise a structure, there are, to me, at least, in the Medical Association, a number of things that are exceedingly critical in the short and long term that should be considered by whatever entity you create, which we are most certainly supportive of, as well as the integration of many of the concepts of Senate Bill 27. But let me go through them very briefly. First of all, we are in the midst of an aging population. Unfortunately, I remember when I started in this business and I was much younger, and I'm certainly much older now. But that also means that our workforce is much older as well. And until the state gets serious about addressing the issues of workforce, healthcare workforce issues, and how we are going to replace those who are going to retire, and we're talking substantial numbers in Oregon, we are going to be in a world of hurt. And it's not just something that is theory. It is serious, and it's going to get more serious. We do not have the capacity in Oregon to produce the number of physicians and other health care providers to replace those who are going to retire. The majority of physicians in this state are over the age of 50. The Medical Association has raised this issue numerous times, and we've only played around the margins. The state has not been serious. In addition, we recruit at least half of the physicians who practice in Oregon, who actually clinically practice in Oregon, from other parts of the state. I travel all over the country, which probably makes you very happy because I'm not around here. I can assure you that everyone knows in my circle of endeavors that we have a negative climate in Oregon. The ability to recruit physicians in this state is exceedingly difficult. They know what the marketplace is like. They know what reimbursement rates are like. They understand markets because these are people who are going to practice for the next 40 or 50 years. And they're going to go in a national market, if not world market, where they believe they can go to the best practice environment. And we have to recognize that and devise some realistic strategies to encourage practitioners, whether they be nurses or others, to continue to practice, to locate here, to have the ability to train enough for our future needs. I mentioned the, and it is a pedestrian issue, and I apologize for that. I'm not above it. I just hate to have to do this, but physician reimbursement in this state is miserable. You can talk to any physician, specialist, primary care, or otherwise, and it's clear it's horrible. I have attached to my testimony a couple of these, just examples. One, You'll see a document that has Oregon at the top, and this is the great benefit of the revisions. You should have it attached. The revisions under the current five-year review of Medicare reimbursement, the SGR, 1%, 1.5% increase pay for performance as well. A huge number of Oregon physicians are going to have a cut this year. They face a 10% Medicare cut if Congress doesn't do something yet again under the Medicare program. Physicians are limiting by larger and larger numbers the number of Medicare patients that they see. The page after this shows what physician practice costs are versus what has happened under Medicare rates of reimbursement. The next page shows what has occurred for different players on payment updates over the course of 3 years, and it tells, I think, a fairly telling tale. This is a very serious problem. It's irrational, it's illogical, and we're continuing to make it even more difficult for a variety of reasons. Pay for performance and quality measures we most certainly support, most certainly in concept, but they're tools. They are not end of a means. They're a means to an end. Merely doing tests on a regularly scheduled basis does not tell you whether a patient has had a good outcome or not. It doesn't tell you whether or not a physician or other practitioner is a good physician, and it most certainly tells you very little about the outcome for a patient. We are in the most elemental stages of quality measures and figuring out how best to design them to be positive incentives and tools for learning and for the benefit of the patient, but they are not that close to prime time at this point. They are coming, but we need to seriously think about the implications of the policies that we may adopt in the future on what some of these programs will do and the costs that are associated with them, because they are huge. Electronic medical records, as you just heard, and there are other stories that have gone on for years where hospitals have invested in electronic medical systems, have lost millions of dollars because they don't work, physicians have refused to use them, and they've had to toss them and move on. We don't have interoperability, and we're not going to have interoperability for quite some time unless we set some policies in place, find some resources, and agree among all the players to break out of their silos and actually agree that we're going to share patient information, hopefully that's secure, if that's possible, so that you, Dr. Bates, and other providers can actually know what the medical conditions and history of patients are. But to merely wish that this occurs and to say it's going to save boatloads of money in the short term, I don't believe is realistic. I think it raises expectations that are unfair and unreasonable, and we need to get down to the serious business of how do we actually produce functional, usable systems that really will enhance patient care, and we're not anywhere close to doing that. Transparency. Representative Cannon has had a major coup in moving us forward in that arena. It is all the rage, but it is also of some limited benefit if it is only limited to certain areas and not all areas. If we don't have transparency for all of the players, including insurers, so that the only people who don't know what they may be paid are in fact the providers who get paid, or we don't begin to talk about serious policy and regulatory parameters for secondary markets that sell physician panels, of which physicians have no control in many instances. We're merely talking rhetoric, and we're not talking about serious system change, in my view. I believe, and the association believes, that competition can be healthy and positive for improving quality and holding down costs, but we have to address the statutory and regulatory barriers that exist in law, in regulation, if you really are going to do that. We can't just add another system and say that it is going to change things without getting down and dirty on trying to figure out why behavior by providers and others are inhibited from providing efficient and effective care. Each patient, as stated earlier, is different. And you can set up protocols for physicians to follow, but it may very well not be the best medical care for the patient that the physician is treating. And that's just, it's undeniable. Every patient is different. Patient safety. I was fortunate, and many of you were involved in this. You may not remember it. Probably voted for it as well, but we did set up a voluntary commission that had appropriated from general fund money, $1, to begin a voluntary patient safety commission. That commission has been struggling for 4 years now. They do receive resources from hospitals who participate, and it was designed that way as a supplement to what we believe to be a state responsibility for having a functioning voluntary patient safety commission that will improve care. The state has chosen, not that you have chosen this, but the state has chosen to decide that it is not a priority for the state to improve patient safety by not appropriating one more dollar in 4 years to that effort. And I think that's very unfortunate. The state has control over 39% of the healthcare insurance market. 54% of the market is either self-insured or insured through Medicare and Medicaid. 17% of the population is uninsured. It is imperative that the state include the entire healthcare system in any kind of reform and agree with former Governor John Kitzhaber that we cannot succeed without federal intervention. Obviously something you have concluded as well. The OMA again applauds your work and dedication. We're committed to working with the committee on a solution that is both rational and logical, a solution that recognizes that we are imprisoned by the status quo and or by the assumptions about the various ills of the system. But let us also recognize that there are many aspects of healthcare that are actually successful, that we have improved the quality of people's lives, enabled our citizens to live longer, and have more fruitful lives, and that we can, in fact, bring people back from death. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the ever effervescent Mr. Gallant?
Frank first.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, I'm trying to read between the lines a little bit. And you used
I've been trying to do that, Senator, for years.
you used some words, and I'd like to ask you if you would maybe comment on what you're really intending. You talk about consolidated markets and top-down management mm-hmm. systems, and then talk about monopolies.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate?
Yeah, I don't think it's a new news to anyone, but the Oregon healthcare market has consolidated over the years, and you have essentially three or four major systems in Oregon that provide hospital services. They have their associated medical staffs, and we have the structures around those that enable you know, all you have to do is look at the statistics where prices have gone up substantially above the MEI, Medicare Economic Index, or other indexes for the provision of health care. There's no doubt about it. And I think that has an impact, an unnecessary impact, on increased costs. You can call them monopsonies or monopolies, whichever. It depends on which part of the state you're in, but that's what they are. They control who practices. They control what is provided. They control you control whether providers get into ambulatory surgical centers, any number of things that have an impact on things. One insurer, I remember last session, when we had one of the great debates about regulating ambulatory surgical centers, whether they were more costly or less costly than others, the fact of the matter is most of those services are about 20% under the market of hospitals. Healthcare services are moving out of hospitals it's not for any evil reason. It's that you can do it for less money. The market is changing, and it's changing slowly. It can change for the right reasons, and it can be a benefit to everybody. But we're right now caught in a paradigm that makes it very hard, for a variety of reasons, to provide efficient, effective care. It's just, I mean, you see it all around. I mean, it's just, to me at least, apparently it's clear as mud to you, but it looks pretty clear to me. Read about it every day.
We'll continue this discussion.
Sure.
You look like you had a question.
Well, I do more than one, but we'll have.
Absolutely, be happy to.
Senator Bass.
Thanks, Chair. Scott, thanks for coming here this evening and speaking to us. And, you know, a couple of points I want to kind of go over again real quickly and then ask for your opinion on a couple of things. Most people in the state don't realize that just as our nursing population is aging, and we've taken steps to try to replace those nurses, that our physician population is aging right along with it. And we have not taken steps to do that. I firmly believe that if it weren't for what I call the second paycheck in Oregon, which is living here and living in a state that has a wonderful environment and great places to eat and do things, we wouldn't have the physicians we do. Even our medical school tells us that only about half the graduates actually stay in the state. And not because they don't want to live here, because they can't make the kind of living here they can make elsewhere. And they've come out of school with big debts, and they've got to work someplace where they can pay those debts off and support their family. Having said that, Oregon is going to be one of the first states, and I think the healthcare system is going to collapse, and it's going to collapse because of lack of Medicare payments. Medicare is going to be a bigger and bigger and bigger part of where the healthcare dollar comes from. We're the lowest state in the union as far as Medicare reimbursement, but there are other states that are just as low as we are, and we're not the only one in this position, and we're going to fill it here first, and we are filling it here first.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways we've dealt with the shortage of physicians is what we've done with our rural health program, and surprisingly, the amount of money that goes into malpractice premiums for physicians is a huge part of the overhead and a huge part of their cost. But in the overall health care dollar, it's a fraction of it, 1/8. What we've done in rural health, because that's where we saw the loss first. We were not maintaining our physician and provider base out there. We were losing specialties. We were losing primary care and obstetrics. We started supplementing those people as far as a malpractice is concerned, and it's been a very, despite what we read in the Oregonian and in my little town of Ashland, which made my summer very warm, despite that, that program has been a roaring success, And as you know, we're going through right now trying to maintain that program for the next 4 years. What I'm getting to here is how much of an impact would it be if the program that Senator Morris is bringing forward and I'm trying to help him with were actually a mirror image of what we're doing in rural Oregon right now. If we were taking that 1/8 of 1% of the health care dollar and significantly supplementing the malpractice premiums paid by physicians, we may not be able to get a Medicare reimbursement up where it should be. That's a federal problem. We're going to go there. We're going to fight for it. We can't afford to put much more into Medicaid, and commercial insurance can only do so much. The cost shift to them is killing them. That's why we're all here tonight. But for a very small amount of money, the entire health care dollar, it appears to me, and this is the role the state would pay, is help those physicians pay their malpractice premiums and try to get them to stop practicing much defensive medicine and start recruiting more physicians from across the nation. Is that something, as you go around, that would make a difference? You could say if you come to Oregon, you have a low malpractice premium, it would make a difference?
Well, excuse me, I didn't mean to talk over you, Senator.
Go right ahead.
I think there are two or three underlying issues that you've raised. One is liability and the cost of it. The other is practicing in rural Oregon and what the state can do to help. We actually have several programs that affect the rural practice for physicians and other practitioners. We have a tax credit which hasn't changed in a decade. It's $5,000 a year. I'm not very good at math, but I have a feeling inflation has had an impact on that. The association has had legislation in the past to try to increase it. Unfortunately, the food fight gets very difficult once you kind of go down that path. But that is a very important tool as well. To understand rural practice, which you do, and I think many of you do, the primary resources paying patients are in two primary categories, Medicaid and Medicare. You've just seen some fairly clear indications of what's going on in Medicare reimbursement. Unfortunately, the uninsured are disproportionately represented in rural Oregon, and there's a very small percentage of rural Oregonians, unfortunately, who are actually privately insured. And so it becomes more acute in those settings when you have the same cost for a surgeon, general surgeon, or someone who's a high-risk specialty, obstetrician, gynecologist, or others, it takes a huge bite out of their net income. Our surveys, a survey by OHSU, which we helped to fund, clearly shows that if the subsidy goes away, a good percentage of physicians will retire. And I don't know how we're going to replace them. I mean, the fact of the matter is the infrastructure to practice in any rural area of the country is very difficult. You typically don't have the infrastructure, the patient load, any number of things to support practices. And I think we need to recognize that. And I think we have through the subsidy program, and we need to continue it, because if we don't, it's just going to have a devastating impact. We argued 4 years ago when the program began, and it was very positive that the governor proposed the program to begin with. It changed, and we argued this. Every physician is dependent on every other physician. The OB is dependent on the surgeon. They're dependent on the anesthesiologist. And you just go down the list. Otherwise, we have behavior of what's going on today. If you have, essentially, in many parts of the state, rural Oregon, if you have a patient who really has a complex problem, they are put in a ambulance or they are put on a plane and they're flown to Portland to be taken care of. We essentially have a triage system, for the most part, in rural Oregon. And we don't have the capacity to deal with really major, serious medical problems there. And we may never have that ability. But we don't really have a rational policy on maintaining a level of care in those areas to at least make sure that we can triage people. Idaho will not accept Oregon Medicaid patients. We pay too little. We have let our trauma system disintegrate to such a degree that we have two level one trauma systems, maybe three, two for sure, in the state. You still have to be cautious about driving down I-5, particularly into southern Oregon, because you may not have a neurosurgeon working. The state really has kind of, we've done some very innovative things. We used to have the premier trauma system in the country because of a couple of, Dr. Long for one, among Dr. Trunke and a few others. But we've let it slide. And we've not really taken the time to seriously look at what kind of structure we have and whether we're really going to rethink and reallocate resources where they're really needed. But I guess to answer your question, other states have done other things. Pennsylvania, they use $1 billion of tobacco money to subsidize liability premiums in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is not a friendly liability state, trust me. And hasn't been for a long time. But the fact of the matter is physicians don't control all of the healthcare dollar. They have some influence about things, but they can't bring down the healthcare expenditures, I think, to the degree that Senator Morse may think, and just not doing defensive medicine, even though it is a major portion of healthcare expenditures. But I do think there are avenues that we can do to reduce that cost and try to make it more rational. And we're more than willing to work with you. I don't know that we can get it done in one session.
Thank you, Scott. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
I want to panel some people up here. So I'd like to call Jason
Gingrich,
and it gives me great pleasure to bring Liz Baxter, finally. Thank you for your attendance. This Jason guy must be a doctor because his handwriting is it's even worse than Bates.
That's hard to believe.
And that is hard to believe.
I don't read my own handwriting half the time.
Go ahead, Jason.
Or you get electronic prescriptions out.
I know what I wrote that way.
Co-chaired Westland and Bates, members of the committee. My name is Jason Gingrich. I'm a Canby resident, chapter leader of the Archimedes movement in Canby. I'm not a physician. I do have messy handwriting, but I also work as a business analyst and a project manager for a small insurance and financial services company based in Indiana. Since beginning to work in the health insurance industry 6 years ago, I've been aware of the double-digit rate increases, the perverse situation the current insurance industry structure puts people in. People like insurance product managers, claims examiners, underwriters, business owners, human resources representatives, healthcare providers, and patients. While I believe that we in the industry do provide a valuable service under the current system, I've also become convinced that the system needs to change. Like many Americans, I'm skeptical of government solutions, but I've become convinced that the current system is not working precisely because the legal framework surrounding it is outdated and that the government, especially the federal government, must change the playing field. Governor Kitzhaber and others, and you're all aware of these issues, so I won't elaborate further. When I joined the Archimedes movement about a year ago, I thought I might get a few friends and relatives interested in our small community. I expected my email list to include a few policy nuts like me. I expected people to yawn when I started talking about this complicated, confusing system. Instead, people have been become engaged. I've got an email list of 69 addresses representing probably about 100 people. I've shown many of them are from the rural area south of Canby. They are retirees, small business owners, nurses, landscaping, construction laborers, students, farmers, stay-at-home mothers. Most are churchgoers. As far as I can tell, I'm the only one with health insurance as a search term on my internet news feed. But people are hungry to talk about their experiences with health care and health insurance. They're frustrated, and they're ready for a fresh perspective. As I've talked to them about the Archimedes movement, there's been some fear, especially about the impact of changing Medicare. But the people I've spoken with, and these people do represent a wide range of political positions, have shown interest in reforming the system in a comprehensive way. Many say it's about time and express their wish that universal health care put in place in this country years ago. Others start out suspicious of quote-unquote socialized medicine, but once I talk to them, they recognize that the current system doesn't make sense and is unsustainable. Many of them recognize that resolving America's healthcare crisis means changes, even costly changes, for all of us. It involves patients taking responsibility for their health. It involves physicians, hospitals, and insurance companies changing the way they do business. It requires government bodies to change the incentives and rules of the road. They know we can't go on like this. Their eyes get pretty big when they hear Governor Kitzhaber and his DVD talk about the $65 trillion Medicare projected deficit and our massive foreign debt as a nation. They're relieved to see a proposal that allows public input into the final plan rather than one prepackaged in a darkened room with some lobbyists who donated big campaign dollars. They're even more relieved when I say that it can be done without a tax increase, that there will be room for them to, quote-unquote, buy up to a richer policy if the basic...
Now, can we interrupt to assure you that's never done in a darkened room?
Okay. You always keep the lights on.
The lights are on.
Smoke-filled, maybe. I guess that's old, too.
Not anymore.
Lots of marijuana.
Hopefully not.
And you have to have a medical card for that. Yeah.
Why the decision-making
has gone down.
I want to thank Governor Kitzhaber and the Archimedes Movement staff and also all of you for allowing me and my chapter members to comment on the early drafts of the Archimedes vision, for focusing on values rather than details, for working on to build a broad consensus that reform is needed and to have a broad discussion about what our healthcare system should look like. This made it possible for the broad range of interests you've heard tonight and Monday night to speak in support of the Oregon Better Health Act. Co-chairs Westland and Bates, members of the committee, I ask you to show us that in Oregon, politicians can lead a process toward a sensible, fiscally responsible, and equitable health care system. I urge you to support the Oregon Better Health Act, and I am pleased to hear today that you're considering merging the Bill 329 with Bill 27, and just hope we can make it possible for Oregon to lead the nation in health care reform. Thanks for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Yeah.
Jason? Thank you for being here. We'll hold questions until Liz has had a chance
okay.
to say her word. Then we'll grill you.
Sorry, my glasses on. Senator Bates, Senator Westland, and Representative Greenlick, and members of both the Senate and House committees. For the record, my name is Liz Baxter, and I'm the project director of the Archimedes Movement. And I want to start by just thanking you for taking the bold steps that led to the joint statement today, describing the work that's going to be coming forward to merge the bills of the language of Senate Bills 329 and 27. This creates an incredible opportunity for health reform legislation to pass during this session. And this is critically important and wouldn't have happened without your hard work and leadership, the extensive work that you've done here in describing the role that a board could play, agreeing to seek the waivers, and talking about improving access. The Archimedes Movement looks forward to continuing to work with you as you move forward in this process. Participants and allies of the Archimedes movement had prepared testimony for tonight prior to learning about what would actually be discussed at the press conference today. And so some have prepared statements in support of Senate Bill 27 without knowing that we would have this big announcement. I was prepared tonight to walk through a description of what the process of engagement looked like for the Archimedes movement, and instead I just have a few remarks that I'll make, and then I'll let others give their testimony. During Monday's committee meeting, you asked questions about anxiety and fear of change, and those indeed are real concerns. What will a new system look like? What will the benefit be? If my health benefits are working well for me now, why can't everybody just get what I'm getting in the same way that I'm getting it? But here were the more prevalent questions. The system is so complex, how can we possibly have an impact on making it better? We all know what needs to change. Why is it so hard to make any headway? Who's going to be the obstacle to achieving health reform? These questions were raised not just by chapters or community members. These same questions came up regardless of whether we were talking to small groups of seniors or the insurance and health plan executives. When we met with physicians and hospital leaders, it was the same discussion. The major stakeholders are willing to be at the table, as you heard at Monday night's meeting, and people in communities all around the state are willing to do the same. Your constituents should be heartened to hear that you will support a bill that describes how we can achieve comprehensive health reform. Oregon will become the first state to take this path, but Oregon has been first before. As part of the development of our We Can Do Better website, staff from White and Kennedy put together a list of other Oregon firsts. They refer to it as their inspiration, and I want to just cite a couple of them. Oregon was the first state to elect a U.S. senator by the direct vote of the people. Previous to this, senators were elected by the state legislature. Oregon was the first state to implement a populist system of legislature in 1903 when it passed measures that allow for referendums, initiatives, and recalls. U.S. Senator Maureen Neuberger of Oregon authored and introduced the first cigarette warning label bill in 1966, which said, caution, cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health. The Oregon Bottle Bill of 1971 was the first container deposit legislation passed in the United States. In 1975, Oregon enacted the first ban of CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons. There's something very special about Oregon. This is a state that's willing to take bold action because it takes something different to be first. We thank you for your leadership and for agreeing once again that Oregon can lead the way. I'd be happy to take any questions if you had some.
Thank you for your service and your leadership, your participation fully and wholly and effectively with the Archimedes movement. Live. It's really quite exceptional. Any questions for this panel?
Is it nice like this all evening? Did I just miss?
No, before you got here, I was my normal irascible, curmudgeon-y self. Senator Mona Sanderson.
I want to commend the Archimedes movement and our leadership here regarding coming together of the plans. And are we planning to go with the same numbers or choose a new number, 0 to 10, that I think the president might have? Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out, that it would be interesting what we're going to do with whose bill. Or a new bill.
Or a new
bill. Everybody's bill. Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your comments, both of you. My question is, the Archimedes movement has developed quite a broad base and a substantial amount of energy. By blending these two bills and now on the path that we're headed, can we sustain that energy, do you think?
Senator Bates and Senator Westlin and Chair Greenlick, Senator Morse, I think that what's been happening with the Archimedes movement has been pretty profound in that everyone, and again, whether they are vested stakeholders in the current system or just folks who are getting together at their church or a coffee house, are beginning to realize that their voice matters, and whether we actually can come up with a sustainable design, that it's important for them to stay engaged in this process, that it's not a matter of getting to a point of a bill and then kind of going away and letting you guys do the work that you need to do. The Archimedes movement is growing, and really one of the goals of the movement has been around community engagement and trying to get, you know, folks like Jason and others that are here to really begin to talk about the things that are important in their community. So we see it being sustained. We see people from the Archimedes movement helping you all throughout the process of moving the bill and designing the new system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a follow-up, the reason I raise that issue is this will not happen without the support outside of this process.
Correct.
So what you're doing is exceedingly important. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I want to actually commend both of you, well, for all of those who are involved in the Archimedes movement, because in my conservative part of Multnomah County, they are talking about it, and they are asking me questions, and they know the name Archimedes, or if they can't remember Archimedes, they at least remember Kitzhaber's name. They know that we have to have health care reform, and they know, and they're waiting for it, so... I'm sure that it's going to be sustained, and especially with the leadership of Bates and Westland now and what they're doing, and their dog and pony show, and I don't know who's the dog and who's the pony, but...
Well, even I'm not touching that one.
I'm careful here, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
First, Jason, I want to thank you and the other people in the Archimedes movement who have volunteered their valuable time and efforts to do what you're doing. I know you started this path. You never thought you'd be ending up in the basement of a Capitol one night talking to some crazy senators. But we appreciate what you've done and what you're hopefully going to continue to do. Liz, the same for you, too. I think what's happened this week is something that's been not only a relief to many people, but a feeling of real strength and energy. This is a case in which I believe the whole is truly larger than the parts, and a combined effort here is going to make this happen, and we'll get a better bill because of it. As you may also be aware, there's been some cross-pollination along the way at various times. John Kitzhaber and I have been friends for over 20 years. I've never forgotten the day I met him. I walked to my office seeing patients, and I walked back to my office, and there's a guy leaning back in my chair with his cowboy boots on my desk saying, "Who are you?" And I'm going, "Who are you?" And we've had a great relationship and friendship since then.
Did he see patients that day?
He didn't go that far for me. He was just there for a discussion about health care. Having said that, many parts of both these plans are very close to each other, and it's because of that, not only the cross-pollination, but because we're all attacking the same problem. And I think melding these bills together will not be that difficult. I think it's something we can do. And what I know and expect will happen from your side is you're going to totally support everything we've got in our bill. And I want to make it very clear tonight that we are going to support totally everything in Senate Bill 27, including the attempt to go and get waivers for Medicaid, Medicare, and other issues that we know have to be dealt with only at the federal level. And that is not a half-hearted effort on our part. It's wholehearted, and I know that you'll be meeting us the same way.
You know, if I could just make one additional comment, I do think that this is very reflective of Oregon, and, you know, not being a native Oregonian myself, but having lived here for 27 years, I've come to know the Oregon character. And the ability to take these two processes and forge a collaboration, I think, is very descriptive of things that happen here in this state that other states are often quite envious of. So we're very excited, and I think your description is quite accurate.
Thank you.
If I could just comment, too, I think my members aren't committed to a particular bill. They're committed to an idea that's better than what we have now. And I think the public education is going to be a big part of making this happen, and that's what we're working for, to help people understand that that we can have a better system. Appreciate your work going on the road for that as well.
Well said, Jason.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Miss Nelly. Long person of passion and participation in this process. Ellie Jenny.
Senator Westland, Senator Bates, for the record, my name is Ellie Jenny, and I tell you, I'm really afraid of what these two bills say, and I'll tell you why. Because when disabled people were rolled over into the health plan, and by the way, we were guaranteed that we wouldn't be harmed and that we wouldn't even be involved in it, but that didn't happen. The health plan has made it a whole lot more difficult for me to live, and I don't have a lot of hope that this is going to help, but that it's going to add to that, and that's my frustration. And so I just want to start from that, saying that I'm afraid. I'm not excited or patting anyone on the back. I'm saying that consumers haven't been involved at all. It's dropped on us, change because we got to, and that means getting rid of denying services and benefits the way I read it. So my life since the Oregon Health Plan has been much more difficult. And I can't see how more rationing, as assumed in Senate Bill 27, will make my life any easier or the many lives of those who live as I live. I know what it's like to live without insurance, and I understand the need. I don't want to be selfish, but I do think it's a bigger picture. I only hope disabled and seniors will not have to have our lives made more difficult with more services denied so this need can be met. I wish I did not have to be dependent on the Oregon Health Plan. I even went to college and graduate school so I could be independent. I worked as a therapist for a number of years, made good money, but when my wheelchair tipped over and I broke my fusion, I wasn't able to go back to work, and that was in 1985. I know Senate Bill 27 plans to set up new provisions for continued care of disabled and blind. I am simply concerned what will happen to the quality of care, durable medical equipment, prescriptions, community care, special procedures, and other areas that many disabled Oregonians will need to stay alive. Because a large percentage of this population is unable, not unwilling, to work, they will not be able to pay for things that are not on this new plan. Will they be denied the services they need to live so others can have insurance? Disabled folks have chronic health care needs and will need services and procedures that are not typical for the general population. Hopefully these consumers that the bill says needs to be on the different boards and commission used to establish criteria for this new plan will be qualified disabled persons and not only professional, lobbyists, and other professionals. To truly meet the needs of those most impacted by this change, they'll have to be a part of the groundwork that establishes every aspect of this new health care plan or fund. Real consumers are those who will be most impacted by this change, those who need this service, and those whose lives are already dependent on the current Oregon health plan delivery system. I also wonder what the legislature is going to do about the huge need when it comes to the shortage of doctors and nurses. I heard you mention that earlier, but I talked to a friend this morning who's a nurse about Senate Bill 27, and her first response was, where are all these Oregonians going to find doctors and nurses to meet their need? Because they, you know, nurses just don't exist. And she said the reason they don't is because the nursing instructors are getting older and older, and there's no young instructors left. So it's hard to recruit nurses from out of state. And I was reading Senate Bill 329. This is not in my written testimony, but I was concerned about the placement on the very first page down not too far about what will be included in this health plan, and advanced directives were there. And that concerns me. I know it's legal, but it just makes me concerned that that's part of the mentality going into this, that it is a form of rationing the way I see it. You know, advanced directives, if the money doesn't exist, then, well, there's always assisted suicide. And you may think that I don't know what I'm talking about or that would never happen, but unfortunately, I know human nature, and that concerns me. So I'm sorry to be negative and try to put cold water on this, but I know I'm not the only disabled person in Oregon that feels this way. And unfortunately, it's very difficult for them to get here and tell you themselves. So I thank you for the opportunity. And if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer if I can.
Any questions for Ms. Jenny?
I do, sir.
Mitch.
What sort of things have been difficult for, what sort of things have not been approved under, you're an OHP plus, I assume, is that right?
Yeah. certain prescriptions, certain therapies, certain kinds of supplies, seeing specialists, which I'm unfortunately dependent upon, those kinds of things. And it's difficult to get around that. And it makes it more difficult for me to have to continually get referrals and prior authorizations. And, you know, to me, it's like jumping through a hoop. I got to call my doctor, wait for him to call me back. Then I've got to call the pharmacist, wait for them to call me back. And a lot of my time is taken up in just, you know, facilitating my own health care.
Let me follow up a bit.
Sure. But you have a sense that's because of OHP regulations or Medicare regulations or...
Well,
is it just a part of the crazy medical care system we have?
No, it wasn't any part of what happened before on Medicaid. It's all part of the Oregon Health Plan. It's their restrictions and necessity to document and, you know, the prior authorizations and the referrals. You know, all those things that came from the Oregon Health Plan. Before the Oregon Health Plan, I never had any of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have a quick question. Are you dual eligible receiving Medicare and Medicaid or just Medicaid?
No. Unfortunately, I didn't work long enough to pay into Social Security to be eligible for Medicare. So I just received Medicaid. And I'm grateful for the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid, but, I mean, Medicaid, mostly the Oregon Health Plan is difficult, but Medicaid is what the program I'm on.
Thank
not,
you.
Not part of the aid of Medicare?
Yeah. It's, what did you say?
Hey, are you not eligible for Part A of Medicare?
No, no. It's my understanding that you've had to have worked to be eligible for any part of Medicare. My accident happened as a teenager, and I don't quite understand, but I have tried to apply, but I know I've been denied.
Thank you.
Ellie, let me tell you something that may give you some comfort, particularly as it relates to, as you say in your testimony, who's on these boards and commissions. I know in 329 we have a specific section on the composition of the board, and we really put that in as a placeholder, and I will allow that as we were first formulating that, and then as you know, I continue to think about it, I was going down kind of the traditional political trail. If you put as many different stakeholders on that board, you get inclusion, and therefore you get buy-in, and I think that leads to creating just a logjam and a mess. So as my thinking on this has evolved, the conclusion I've come to is who should have the preponderance of positions on that board should be determined by how you answer this question. And it is, who does that board represent? And to my lights, and this is one individual speaking, it represents patients and it represents payers, those who are paying the bill. That's who should be, you know, the preponderance, not the only, but the preponderance should have the preponderance of positions on that board. I know we will have robust discussions and testimony on that very subject, but just from where I sit, that's where I think the board and how it should be structured.
I agree. I understand, you know, that the folks that pay for it, otherwise, you know, the consumers, they don't really may not understand that dynamic or know exactly what's involved. And, you know, it is important to know what the numbers are that you're working with in regard to being able to provide services. But at the same time, I believe that the population that is most impacted by what decisions come out of that commission or fund or whatever it's called should be involved, because, you know, their life is impacted. And I mean, not just on the periphery by coming in and giving testimony or sitting there and hoping you can understand what's going on and trying to keep on top of all the printouts that are being, you know, discussed and such. I think more than one consumer should be at the table. And I believe that a disabled consumer should be there, because I wish it weren't so. I would rather be doing a whole bunch of other things than down here in front of you guys. Nothing personal, but that's kind of where I'm at. But I do believe that's the way that the professionals, the providers, the payers, whatever they're called, really know the picture, is if they hear it from real consumers. And I mean, yeah, able-bodied folks consume, but disabled folks, we live in a world that's totally different. And what we consume and what we, our perspective is different. And I just think that the program is better served. I'm not saying a whole bunch of consumers, but I'm just saying more than one. And I believe some qualified disabled, you know, articulate person who's not going to, you know, they're not going to make a lot of demands, but I do believe they will be there to enlighten, because that should be something that the group would want, the most comprehensive and complete plan possible.
I think that's what Oregon demands. Thank you very much.
Oh.
Okay, again, this is my reading skills, not writing problem. Arnie Potella? Potella? Hey, and Rob Johnson. Enter and sign in, please. How about Scott Manchester? Is Scott there? We've got two more after this panel, so we're doing pretty good. Your choice, gentlemen.
Well, they're pointing at me, I guess. My name's Scott Manchester, and I am quite recently became a staff member of the Oregon Health Action Campaign. I'm here today to let you know that we have some concerns about Senate Bill 27 and Senate Bill 329, and we're hopeful that there will be a lot of further discussion that includes involvement from all the many groups of patients and consumers in the state that will be affected by this bill. We are still working on developing a detailed position statement, and we will come to you at some future date with more information about our position on the bill. We have, I think I signed the sign-up sheet as neutral, and that's more or less where we're at this point on the bill, although we have always been supportive of expanding health care to all Oregonians, and we commend the Archimedes movement for their efforts to keep the process going and the process of reform moving forward in Oregon. Our concern is that Oregon does not lose sight of the vital role that Medicaid plays in the lives of Oregon's elderly and people with disabilities. Those populations rely on Medicaid for more than medical care. For many people who are elderly and disabled, Medicaid provides attendant care, in-home supports, long-term care, resources provided by the home and community-based waiver that supports individuals living outside of institutions, parent training, county case management for high-risk and vulnerable children and families, and the list goes on. So within our understanding of the Archimedes movement's proposal is that the intent is to redistribute all Medicaid money, Medicare money, and employer tax advantages to provide a set of health benefits that does greatest good to the greatest number of people. And in that context, we want to urge you to not lose sight of the fact that there are some populations that may have special needs, and we don't want to thin the soup for that population. So that's the concern that we wanted to put on the table today.
You know, Scott, it may just call your attention to the principles of in 329, where we make special or specific reference to special needs populations, and we're very clear and very adamant about that. So you just keep expressing that concern, and we will continue to listen, and I think this will be, you know, better than fine. I think this will be very beneficial for the populations you refer to. I understand your concerns.
Thank you.
Next.
Co-chairs Westland and Bates and the rest of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Arnold Potella. I'm a licensed health insurance agent in Oregon and have been since 1977. I've been actively involved in health reform issues since on the state and federal level since 1990, and I've served as both a state and the national legislative chairs for the Association of Health Underwriters. Today I'm actually just speaking as a citizen rather than a member of any of those associations about the Archimedes movement and that's been resulted in Senate Bill 27, also known as the Oregon Better Health Act. And first I'd like to also just tell Scott, because of the process, so Jason Gingrich had described the cross-section of people that we've had on these committees, on these, in these various chapters, That very issue with regard to special needs has been discussed within our chapter, and I wouldn't doubt most of the other chapters within the state. The second thing I'd like to do is really congratulate and thank you for being willing to put Senate Bill 27 and 329 together. It was a great announcement that you did today, and we really appreciate that. And with regard to excitement, you could see, as I recall, John Kitzhaber said that there were a little over 6,000 members of the Archimedes movement right now. Not, thank God all of them don't come to the meetings, but we do get input. So there is a lot of chatter going on within the blogs. And so it's a very enthusiastic committee, group of people made up of everyone within the state of Oregon. The main thing I want to testify on is that I've been involved in the Oregon Health Assessment Project. I've been involved in a lot of think tank types of operations around health care. And this process that we've had with the Archimedes movement has certainly been the most open process I have ever experienced. Specifically, our chapter spend at least two meetings discussing the concept that we all recognize that is somewhat offensive to certain people, and that is personal responsibility. That is, we're personally responsible for our own health as well as our health care. And because of the work of our chapter and probably other chapters within the state as well, that principle was actually modified, so it's now stated as a shared responsibility between individual, employers, health systems, and communities. So I could see real effects that we had on the wording of the bill and was excited about that. I guess the only criticism I would have of the whole process is the fact that it was so short. In other words, we started last June and needed to get something together so we could have something being written up for the bill in September so they could present it as a bill here at the legislature. So that was the only criticism, and I don't know how it could been done any faster than that in all reality, but I guess it's more of a wish than a criticism. I'd like to add two other comments regarding melding of these two bills. In both bills, the concept of choice is stated. And first, I recommend that the discussion around choice include options for health plans of different benefit design, like PPOs, HMOs, and this new thing called consumer-driven health plans. In other words, high-deductible health plans. Approximately 50% of my clients have these high-deductible health plans connected with health savings accounts. I spend a lot of time in enrollment meetings educating people about these. And what I can tell you from what I hear at these meetings, and also from my own experience going on a high deductible health plan, it changes the way we utilize health care. To the extent, since we're spending our own money for health care, we're much more careful about the way we use it. It's not just a $20 copay to go see the physician. It's $110 or $300, depending upon whether we're seeing a primary care physician or a specialist. Secondly, I heard on Monday Dr. Bates mention pooling of monies. And I think that's one of the things that is most major criticism of these high-deductible health plans is they say, well, gee, not everybody's pooling their money. In fact, that seems to be looking like as a separate pool. The thing I would mention is because of the high-deductible health plan people actually utilize services much more carefully, I would suggest that the low-deductible health plans are not the people that are utilizing those services don't look at them as critically, and therefore probably overutilize the plans rather than utilize them properly. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Scott. Rob?
Now, I must say, the last time I saw Mr. Johnson, he was at a late-night establishment here in Salem, and there was quite a bit of noise coming from the booth that he and others were in.
Thank you for that introduction.
Yes.
thank you.
You could ask
the chair what he was doing there.
I think he was actually with you, Co-Chair.
I just remember that.
And the former governor and Senator Johnson, and we are working on critical public policy issues that your fun and frivolity, the shrill laughter, frequently interrupted.
I apologize.
My goodness.
And despite that, we worked out the agreement that night.
That's right.
So maybe you helped.
Yeah, maybe we did. Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Rob Johnson, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent long-term care facilities in Oregon, ranging from skilled nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, and senior housing communities. We would like to offer our support for efforts and measures aimed at increasing access to healthcare coverage for all Oregonians, including the approaches that co-chairs Bates and Westland and former Governor Kitzhaber have offered. We remain concerned, however, about any approach that would wrap funding for housing and long-term care services provided through Medicare into a state health care reform package. Medicare coverage, as you all know, extends beyond acute care services performed in a hospital or outpatient setting. In fact, many of Oregon's seniors receiving long-term care services are covered by Medicare during their stays in Oregon nursing homes. According to a 2005 report published by the Oregon Office of Health Policy and Research, Medicare paid for just over 18% of total patient days in Oregon nursing facilities. Of all the health care coverage options available to Oregon seniors, Medicare remains the most stable and reliable. Variations in Oregon state budget have constricted Oregon's Medicaid program on more than one occasion, but the federal Medicare program has consistently provided steady health care coverage for Oregon seniors. Rather than risk subjecting some of Oregon's most vulnerable populations to potential reductions in benefits, limited eligibility, or additional cost-sharing burdens, it's OHCA's position that any attempt to balance the needs of the elderly with those of the non-elderly should be approached with extreme caution. Medicare can and should serve as a model for any health care reform proposals at the state level and should continue to serve as a platform for expanding access to health care services. In that spirit, we're concerned that Senate Bill 27 in particular specifically provides for a restructure of the Medicare program by moving Oregon seniors and people with disabilities out of the Medicare program into a state program in order to fund health care services for all Oregonians. While we're very supportive of any attempts to increase health care coverage for more Oregonians, we remain wary that dismantling a proven program such as Medicare jeopardizes the health and well-being of Oregon's frail and vulnerable populations. Oregon can achieve increased access without risking access for seniors, and we encourage all members of the committee to seek alternative solutions than a state-based program for seniors and people with disabilities. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this important topic and hope that we can work together in the days ahead to reach a workable solution.
Mr. Chair.
We'll take you up on that offer. Representative Greenlink.
What specifically are the elements of Medicare that you think needs to be emulated in our health care system of the future?
I think in particular the fact that it's a steady source of funding, whereas the Medicaid program, because of rises and falls in the economic climate of Oregon, is just less dependable.
So you're suggesting we start a payroll tax?
No, I'm
that's
certainly
the source
not
of funding in Medicare, right?
All I'm suggesting is that changes in Medicare should be discussed at a federal level, and there are discussions going on within Congress to work on that very problem.
I understand your statement that we ought to be worried about changing Medicare, but I thought I heard you say that Medicare is the model that we ought to be using as we design a healthcare system of the future. Something like that I heard you say, I think.
Representative Greenlink, as far as long-term care is concerned, it is a model, like I said, because of the steady source of funding as compared to Medicaid.
A payroll tax.
That's what Medicare is.
Yeah.
Medicare is a payroll tax.
I'm not saying specifically the payroll tax itself, but
That's the steady source of funding, right? I mean, yeah. Medicare Part A is funded by a payroll tax that's paid right by both employees and employers, and Part B is paid out of the current deficit of the federal government. Now, if you think those are steady sources of funding, I'm intrigued.
I'm simply just trying to assert that changes in the Medicare program should be addressed at the federal level rather than at the state level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I was late. I was going to ask a couple quick questions.
Sure.
I'll make this one comment to you about Medicare. I would point out that the Medicare system you're most concerned about is obviously long-term care, but with the Medicare system right now in this state, half the doctors don't take Medicare anymore.
Sure.
That is not a system I want to emulate. Arnold, I'd like to give you something here that may give you some help and some reassurance. The very discussion you led us into here is one we had long and hard all through last year about what kind of plans these accountable health plans would be. We want the diversity you're talking about. We absolutely want it.
We want
people to get an Oregon health card that will buy them whichever one of those plans they pick, including plans that have HSAs in them. The only caveat that we have for HSAs is that exempted from them would be certain aspects of preventative care that we want no barriers to. Annual physical examination for women is a big example. Colonoscopy after age 50. Immunizations for children. We want no barriers for that. We've seen these kind of programs working in some self-insured, such as Fred Meyer, where they have 65,000 lives. They have offered three different plans, one of which has an HSA. They have had the same findings you have about holding health care costs down. But they exempted certain areas for that. And as a result, they had great preventative care, but people became much more acute and selective about how they spent the rest of their money. It does work. And we want those plans built into this plan.
Yeah. Senator Bates, if I can comment, Aetna has done roughly the same type of thing. And the plans that I'm talking about, even the one I'm on, does exempt preventive care. You don't have to pay the deductible. Matter of fact, my preventive care is free. What's unique about Aetna is they've taken some of the preventive care drugs, I mean like blood pressure medication, they've classified that as preventive, which clearly as a doctor, you probably would agree with that.
Thank you.
Any questions? Question? Gentlemen, thank you so very much. I'll invite up our last panel, Michael Grady and Catherine White.
Thank you.
Oh, not that Catherine White. Oh. Yeah, not that Michael. Oh, man. Thank you for being here.
Go ahead. Any guy with that kind of a haircut is okay.
There you go. There you go.
Chair Westland and Chair Bates, my name is, and members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition, and first we wanted to indicate our support for the discussions that have been going on and our commitment, reiterate our commitment to be involved. We have been meeting with some of you very involved with Senate Bill 329 and very recently with Governor Kitzhaber on Senate Bill 27. And in the process of the discussions, our focus was primarily and firstly on the concept of rolling all of Medicaid into either the entity or the health fund. And we pointed out in these discussions that Medicaid funds two types of things, medical services and community-based services like the home and community-based waiver. Included that in that are things like eligibility determination, protective services, foster care for children and for adults, in-home services for children and adults, residential services, job and employment services, in-home services. These are all services that are provided as a part of that aspect, the community services aspect of Medicaid. We definitely see a relationship between those community services and health care in creating wellness for people. But we feel that it is very important in these discussions to separate those two things. In our conversations, we did get a sense that there was a support for separating those two and making it very clear in the legislation that they were two different portions of Medicaid. We're very committed to being involved in the discussions and feel that there are huge discussions in terms of the health care aspect of Medicaid and making it work for people with disabilities and other vulnerable populations, and we're very committed to be a participant in that. And we urge you to make it very clear to alleviate some of the confusion that's currently generating out in the communities and the concerns that are generating out in the communities about the $3.1 billion in community-based services that Medicaid is involved in Oregon. Thank you.
Michael, can I ask what proportion of Medicaid dollars are in that pot that you're talking about? I seem to remember it's more than half, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, I don't know the proportion exactly, but it is a high proportion.
I think it's more than half.
I think
it's more than half, yeah.
Just standard 60-40 match stuff?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the total portion of Medicaid, how much is directed toward the community service, long-term service element?
No, of the 3.1 that was, I heard you say 3.1 spent in...
I think that figure comes from what it would cost to replace if all of the services that are currently funded under that service portion of Medicaid, if all of that funding were taken out, and that would be what it would cost the state to replicate the funding for those services.
$3.1
billion?
Mm-hmm. More than half.
Mm-hmm. I'll talk about that later. I'm having trouble with that figure.
Mr. Chair. Just to clarify a few areas here, in the long run, those two things can't be separated very carefully. Clearly we're not going to rob Peter to pay Paul here. That is not the purpose, okay? But there are many people in the Medicare program whose needs for supportive care at their home or elsewhere is not available for Medicare. It should be. And we would want to talk about that, okay? That is part of the conversation. There are cases when Medicaid recipients are in the same situation. The lady behind you in the wheelchair is a good example of that. And those programs have been cut, but they're not the ones we've been talking about, but they need to be looked at again, too. There are a few examples of the state of what we call wraparound programs, where the healthcare and the home needs and the needs of the patient are taken care of in one complete program. And some of those pilot programs have worked very well. I would not want to preclude those also because it works to the benefit of the disabled person or the elderly person. So I want to be clear that those were not ones where, because now we're going to have somebody else come in here and say, wait a minute, you're touching our program now. There are innovative ways to combine these that can work much better for the patient, and I don't want to lose those. But I am not interested in taking money from one side and dropping it to the other at the expense of home agencies or things of that nature. Just to be very clear about it.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I agree completely, and I think we're very excited about the idea of working closely on innovative ways of delivering health care and our commitment to wellness, which includes that intersection of those two elements of the Medicaid plan. But our concern was definitely along the lines of losing things like foster care.
I hear you.
Michael.
Okay. Senator Westland, Senator Bates, members of the committee. My name is Mike Grady. I am a family physician in Silverton and medical director of a clinic there devoted to OHP patients. I also volunteer at a free clinic in the community. I am currently president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, and while I don't appear in that role this evening, I know I speak for many of my members individually when I thank you for your hard work in addressing comprehensive reform in healthcare, both before and during this session. We are very grateful. I've done a number of public presentations on behalf of the Archimedes movement and became involved because I am so frustrated with our healthcare system on a number of levels. I'm tired of stories of sick patients going to feed stores to get veterinary-grade antibiotics to avoid the expense of going to the emergency room. My heart aches when Patients tell me they make choices between food and medicine, and that their pride is hurt when they have to go to food banks to make ends meet because of the cost of their medications. I'm ashamed as a citizen when I see mayonnaise jars in convenience stores with hand-lettered signs soliciting funds for someone's medical care, or families and churches holding spaghetti dinners so a child can get needed cancer treatment. I think we fail to realize sometimes that citizens of other industrialized countries don't have to do this. It is demeaning to the people involved and shameful for us as a society. We can do better. I am frustrated on another level as well, our inability to, for so long, fail to address this in a comprehensive way. And that is why I have such gratitude for your work and the vision of the Archimedes movement. For over 20 years now, we've seen these lines on a graph of increasing numbers of insured and increasing costs. And not only have we failed to see that these trends are in some way related, but we've persisted in this approach of incremental reform even when it hasn't worked, and figuratively speaking, failed to sit down as a society to actually fix this. So we fail both at the recognizing the injustice of excluding so many citizens from care, and then also failing to realize that there has to be limits to what publicly funded health care can provide if we're going to have a sustainable system. As Governor Kitzhaber has pointed out, the underpinnings of our system reflect the realities of half a century ago. Not only does an employer-based system make our companies less competitive in a global economy, but often fails patients when they need it the most. A year ago, I was working in a public health service clinic in St. Bernard Parish in Louisiana. 6 months after Katrina, 90% of the businesses had not returned to the parish, and most of the adults were unemployed and therefore uninsured. I saw very many sick people who'd been off their medications for blood pressure, for diabetes, for heart disease for several months, and I know that many of them face a premature death. We know, in fact, from an Institute of Medicine report 5 years ago that almost 20,000 people die every year just because they lack insurance coverage in this country. It seemed to me so absurd that people facing such misery and hardship should have to lose their medical care at a time when so many of their other needs were not being met as well. So our citizens deserve a healthcare system that is there regardless of who they work for, what age they are, whether they have membership in a privileged category, or whether a 6-foot wall of water traveling 60 miles an hour devastates their community some August morning. This is something that we owe each other, especially in a society with the resources that we have. We need to find the political will to make this happen. And I believe the time is now, and I believe Senate Bill 329, Senate Bill 27 is the answer. So I'm going to end with a quote. I was going for one from Martin Luther King Jr., but Senator Westland beat me to it at the rally today. So I'll offer one from Winston Churchill, who once famously said of Americans that he believed that they would always do the right thing after they tried everything else first. And we are at that point in healthcare. We need to be bold, and we need to do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Any questions or comments?
Just the last statement. Dr. Grady, I have heard of your clinic in Silverton, and I thank you for your good work. You take care of part of the population that many people won't. You do it for charitable wages, and I appreciate your efforts. I also appreciate you going down to New Orleans and volunteering your time. Thank you.
As sure. Did Dr. Bates' wife.
Mitch. Thank you. I'll try a quote from H.L. Mencken, who said, "For every complex human problem, there's a solution that's simple, elegant, and wrong." We can live a rich fantasy life about what the healthcare system is, and you heard me talk about that earlier at noon if you were at the rally. To a certain extent, Senate Bill 27 and Senate Bill 329 are kind of a Rorschach test of what you have this ink blot that, you know, it might look like sex or it might look like the ideal healthcare system. Could you imagine, fantasize with us for a bit, we get the waiver, we have the commissions working, we've now taken all the income tax from everything, and we've taken the Medicare, we've taken the Medicaid, we put in some state money, we now have the utopian healthcare system that only covers a skinny amount of the medicine, but people can buy up if they want complicated healthcare. Somehow there's a vision in there about a new medical care system. What does that new medical care system look like to you, Dr. Brady, as a practicing physician?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm encouraged to believe that the process that we'll go through to arrive at a prioritized list of services and stuff will help us put in the proper place some probably less effective things that contribute to the cost of the system. You know, I mentioned some examples of people not getting care. I could easily mention some examples of people getting inappropriately too much care.
Okay, let's say you cut me out of getting care in my last year of life. That mm-hmm. might save my life, but I'm willing to accept that notion. How are you going to be paid? How are you going to practice? How is life going to be different? How will people know what they have? What's this miraculous healthcare system that if I was in control, if I were king, I could figure yeah. out? But what do you imagine will come out, say, 6 years from now, 8 years from now? You'll be still practicing family medicine. What's it going to be like?
Well,
what is this utopian?
It'll be a system that is at the very minimum just and also sustainable. It'll be one that we know the price tag of, because we'll determine how much as a society we can afford to pay. And of course, we all have the example of the
I'll tell you how much we'll pay, but what I'm asking you is, what's the healthcare system going to look like? I mean, we're now paying $17 million. Uh-huh. All those dollars together will create about $12 million.
Yeah.
Billion.
Yeah.
So we'll be saving about $5 billion yeah. in the healthcare uh-huh. system if we fantasize this way.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to be a working physician. How
yeah.
what's the healthcare system? Not will it be sustainable, mm-hmm. not will it be beautiful, not will it be efficient, not will it sound like Mozart. Mm-hmm. What's it actually going to be like in terms mm-hmm. of you as a physician or me as a patient living in this utopian world? That is going to be the question
yeah.
we need to ask ourselves over the next several years, it seems to
yeah.
me. All of the reform things have underneath an assumption that we can change the way we organize and deliver healthcare services, and therefore save enough money to bring people into the healthcare system that are excluded now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder what day to day that's going to be like. How are you going to get paid? Fee for service, still?
Actually, I think in this committee's probably heard all the testimony about the medical home concept and the importance of that in the future delivery of healthcare. And I think coming at a medical home for people, a primary care medical home, is going to be a large step with more integrated care, use of information systems, more universally. I think that's going to be a big piece of that. It's going to look a little different. And
if I don't want to go to a medical home, what if I want to go to Dr. Bates?
Yeah.
I like the way he's there on Saturday and Sunday. I don't want to go to medical home.
Well, you could be, yeah. Medical home might be a single office and one provider or two providers, but who have committed to being the resource for their patients, whatever their needs. When I try and explain this to my office staff, I say it's, if somebody comes to you with a question, regardless of what it is, you tell them in effect, that you've come to the right place, kind of a Nordstrom approach to this, that we will assume...
I understand if we can go visit Kaiser and see how it works.
Yeah, we will assume responsibility for getting you to what you need in the healthcare system.
And you'll have the money in your pocket to pay for it.
Well, I think that the reimbursement model will have to change, but that I can, physicians like me can get reimbursed for doing things that other than the conventional face-to-face fee-for-service visit. So if we get paid more for coordination of care, for emailing patients and taking advantage of and doing same-day access and extended hours, if we're going to make that kind of commitment in our primary care practices, I think that will, and
know,
get paid for it, that will make a difference.
I know when I talk to family care physicians, primary care docs, you know, the first thing they answer to that question, Mitch, is same day or next day appointments and being able to spend enough time with their patients to be able to not only, you know, treat the immediate symptom or cause of their vision, but help change health behaviors outside of the office that allows them not to come back. That's what I hear time and time and time again in a, you know, better allocated, more utopian type of system.
I've used an oncologist, pulmonologist, a dermatologist, a neurologist, an oncologist, an internist, and I've missed psychiatry in that.
What you needed.
Yeah, your interpretation of Rorschach ink blots is much to be desired. We can tell you that right now.
Mr. Chair. Mitch has a great question. It really is. And, you know, those of us who are on the front lines and sort of the fog of battle, it's hard to step back and say, gosh, what would that really look like? But I've had both hats on during these last two or three years, both practicing physician and being here. And I do have that vision. Mm-hmm. And the vision is this. First thing that happens is all those people in the front of my office that are doing health insurance premiums and running around doing paperwork, they're all gone. Instead, I've got maybe a social worker there, mm-hmm. or a mental health worker there, mm-hmm. that I can immediately talk to and work with. Mm-hmm. I have a network I can work with. I can do just what he said. I can spend time with my patients at that time, and I'll be reimbursed for that for a change. And those patients that I can deal with either through email, which you know I can't do, but by phone, which I can do and used to do and would like to do again, I deal with that way. Mm-hmm. Those patients like yourself, who've gone through, have a major illness that really needs subspecialty or specialty care, I'll make sure they get that care. I'll have time to call that physician up, mm-hmm. discuss the case with him, go over the case with him or her, and make sure they get the care they need. I'll have time to do that. I won't be seeing 35 patients a day or 30 patients a day or 25 patients a day or whatever it takes to churn people through and make a living.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be trying to buy into MRI and CT machines and big labs so I can enhance my income to the point that I can stay open. I would be getting my income based on those patients I see or don't see in a unified system that really works. That's my vision. That's where I want to go, and I think this system has an opportunity to let us go there.
Right. Yeah, I have that same vision, too. I imagine, but I want to see how shared this is. I imagine being in a system that's fully capitated. Imagine being in a system that's a group practice model where physicians work together. Imagine being in a system where the hospital is owned by the physicians, by the system, and the physicians and administrators make that decision. I imagine being in a place that has a complete medical record system, mm-hmm. so I can go anywhere to get an injection when I need anticoagulation therapy. I envision that, and I've lived in that system for the last 42 years. Mm-hmm. And I know it works, and I see it. It's called Kaiser Permanente. Mm-hmm. But the question is, are we going to convert the world to a big Kaiser Permanente? Or are you going to imagine becoming a part of a prepaid group practice capitated system down in Medford? I mean, I don't think so. I don't think the world is going to turn to that kind of a system. And yet, it's kind of required. I mean, something like that. I do communicate with all my doctors by email
copying each other so they all know what's going on. I mean, I can see that vision, but for 40 years I've looked at how we get from there, which what serves 15% of the population or 20% of the population, and you add some Providence folks and you have another 10% of the population. How do we get from there to the whole healthcare system looking like something like that, or the functional equivalent? I was just wondering, you've been thinking about this, and we've got 6,500 people in the Archimedes movement thinking about this. Don't talk about federal mandates. Talk about what the system's going to look like when we get to, well, we, not utopia, because I can tell you that Kaiser is not utopia. Plenty of problems in it.
Yeah.
But how do we get from where we are to where we need to be in order to create the world that people can live in, that you can practice in, that patients can feel comfortable in, and that, you know, life actually comes out that way. And it's true, the medical home is a piece of it, lots of it. And that's what we need to begin to struggle with somewhere along the line.
I would offer that model's over there in front of us. RIPA, as a good example, Mid-Rogue IPA, is doing that right now. They're rolling out their EMR. They're paid both by a combination of fee-for-service and compensation based on the number of patients in your panel.
Mm-hmm.
They have a close relationship with their hospital, and they are able to spend time with the patient needs it and deal with the rest of it by phone or email. And they're compensated for doing that. They're compensated on an annual basis for doing that, and it works. And it's admittedly, it's very much the Kaiser system. It's just a little different model to get the same results. So it can happen. It's taken them 6-7 years to get there. And we can move the whole system that way, but it'll take time.
What proportion of the county is covered in that system?
It's in, from RIPA, it's the entire Medicaid population the county is covered.
What proportion of the whole county is?
16%.
Okay. Sort of like Kaiser.
Yeah, but they're only limited by the fact they're in Medicaid. They're moving into Medicare now and other forms of care.
And maybe, Mitch, a more specific answer to your question, you know, 27 calls for this, is the creation of safe harbors to discuss just such questions as you articulately pose. I mean, we have the methodology in place to get, you know, to these, you know, very detailed, very specific. I shouldn't say we have it in place. I mean, once we bring the bills together, I mean, the portion of 27 calls for just such a discussion at very in-depth and detailed levels. So,
well, I believe we can do it.
I believe you're right.
You know what?
I believe it.
I believe you're
we
right.
We need to be thinking about this kind
so
of
thing. So does everyone out there.
Yeah.
I want to thank not only the committee for excellent discussion tonight, but certainly all of the testifiers. This has been one of the most uplifting meetings I think we've had. It's been the most uplifting meeting. So, you know, from here, we go forward. We're adjourned.
Thank you.